Some of them were built by families desperate for anywhere to live in the Depression, others by fishermen after the war and hippies in the 60s. Beach shacks made with flotsam, jetsam and old tin. Councils want them gone, but they're now fiercely protected because, as Anna Clark writes, these shacks are now an iconic part of Australian coastal history. Anna is a professor at the Australian Centre for Public History at UTS, the University of Technology, Sydney. She's the author of a very serious and much admired book, Making Australian History, and she's nuts about fishing. She's written a history of that too, called The Catch. Now she's working on a history of the beach, which we're digging into for this talk about beach shacks. Anna, welcome.
Hi, David.
Anna, I have to ask, you write about beach shacks loved by shackies.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a shackie?
Oh, gosh. I had never thought of myself as a shackie, but the term emerged as I was researching for this piece of work about beach shacks and the people who love them. And it comes from sort of shack communities of shackies. And so technically, I suppose I am, in the sense that I'm very fortunate to access a shack that my parents bought a long time ago. Is actually on my grandparents' old farm on the south coast of New South Wales.
So how do you define a shack? Because I suspect the shack you're talking about probably has running water and flush toilets. That's not a shack, is it?
It doesn't have running water or flush toilets.
Aha.
Our family's shack has a solar panel which runs a little light and a fridge and has tank water, no hot water, we cook on a fire. It's actually a hippie shack built by hippies in the late 1960s, early 1970s. I'd say most people think about the beach shack as exactly as humble as you sort of, described there. Maybe fibro, maybe bits of, repurposed corrugated iron, bit of driftwood, fishing boys washed up. Sort of hanging around like a
net
acting as some sort of awning or passion fruit vine trellis.
I have a theory, and because this is a very academic discussion.
Theories
need to be closely investigated. I have a theory that lots of us think we've had holidays at beach shacks when we were children, but we really haven't, but we've just read about them.
Is it like the sort of memory of the moon landing, which actually happened before I was born, but I feel like I remember it because it's so ubiquitously all around?
Yes, I think it could be that, though I, of course, watched the moon landing in a small television set up in the rural bank headquarters in town. I think it's that, and in Very Old People, I was there when the Queen landed in 1954. But let's divide up the shacks. Very interesting you've mentioned a third category, because it's not just fisher folk, depression folk, but it's also hippies.
Yeah.
Let's go to the fisher folk shack.
Yeah.
Why build a shack? Why not just come and go?
Yeah, well, I suppose in the, when fishing shacks first started to be built in the late 19th century, it was a time when Australians became more interested in the natural world, and things like the Royal National Park is declared, bushwalking groups appear, bird watching groups appear, and fishing, and people had always fished in Australia, of course, even in First Nations communities into deep time, but in terms of, colonial shacks, there was a growing sense or a growing interest in fishing for pleasure on the weekend. The weekend becomes a thing, And so rather than just sort of pitching a tent in the sand dunes, which many people did, when they found the spot they wanted, they put up a little shack so they could stash their stuff.
And presumably to be on hand when the tide is right.
Absolutely. To be on hand when the tide is right, to come back to the same place, to be able to return for holidays, for weekends, for the right moons and tides. And also these places were on public land invariably. There are some exceptions, but a lot of them are where there's no development. So the access to these places is facilitated because they're often quite remote and they're on public land.
And kind of nobody else wants them. Once you've built your shack, it was yours, wasn't it? They were just like squatters, weren't they?
Yeah.
You claimed your spot and it was your spot.
Yes, and you kind of perched there. And, you know, sometimes these communities were actually farmers in Western Australia, for example, who in between farming seasons went to the beach to have a summer holiday or to have a little bit of an annual holiday. They came with stuff. And then on Crown land, they would put up a little shack to return to every year.
And then if they brought their family, the shack had to get bigger.
That's right. So the sort of the shack that you're alluding to in what a shack looks like is cobbled together, literally, and maybe another room is added to. They're sort of like lean-tos. And the earliest ones would have been kerosene tins and driftwood, as you say. And over the years, as they get added to and as people have access to more things, that sort of very basic shack, if it hasn't washed away, becomes a little bit more permanent.
And they do survive.
Yes, absolutely.
How old are the oldest shacks?
Well, the ones that we know, I think, you know, probably from the 1920s, there might be earlier, so happy to be directed to any earlier ones by people. There are obviously remnants of Aboriginal occupation of beach sites all around the country, but timber doesn't last. So these beach shacks are actually quite recent, mostly in the 20th century. And there were some in the late 19th century, I believe, but they were very sort of basic and you know, literally washed away.
So we should acknowledge the fourth and original category of beach shack, which is the Indigenous beach shack.
That's right. And, you know, there are the first sort of colonial accounts of First Nations culture do mention these shacks right around the coast as you know, colonists encountered First Nations society. You know, people have been living on the beach for thousands and thousands of years. And if you think of the sort of natural bounty of Australia and sea life, you know, of course the beach was occupied. And people after then thought that was a good idea too.
But then comes the Depression. And in the Depression, people are desperate to find somewhere to live.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, it's the coast where they're able to find unwanted land. How on earth could beaches be the unwanted land of the Depression?
I know. It's one of the sort of really curious stories about this history, actually, is in the 1920s, you know, beach shacks are sort of built by workers, often, you know, quite humble working shacks of people wanting to get away for the weekend and make holiday and sort of have holidays. And in the 1930s, some of those workers, many of those workers, lose their jobs. And where do they go? They go to these beach communities. And for those who didn't have a shack in these beach communities, they walk down to the community and build a shack there. And, like, it's amazing when we think of the sort of you know, the wealth that's required to have a coastal property today. In the 1930s, the coast was the worst sort of land because there wasn't this sort of sense of, you know, the exclusiveness of the coast. The coast was the crappy farmland. So that a lot of it was actually quite accessible. And that's where these shack communities grew up.
Bondi was a working class suburb.
Yeah, there were shack communities in the Depression, you know, in the Northern Beaches, on the sort of headlands there where people camped for years during the Great Depression.
Do any of these Depression villages survive around Australia?
Yeah, they do, particularly in the Royal National Park south of Sydney. There are some incredible shacks there that have their origins from the sort of 1920s onwards, but during the Great Depression, they became permanently occupied and they're still standing. And in fact, they now have heritage protection.
So the local councils have been told to back off.
Well, it's been a tricky sort of, you know, it's because they were built on different parcels of land. Like in the Royal National Park, they were built on actually on an existing farm, and it's only when they became resumed, when that land became taken up by the Royal National Park that this conflict about what should be there emerged. But a lot of the shack communities were actually built on Crown land.
Who owns these shacks now? Not Depression folk.
Well, the sort of, if you live in a shack, you don't feel like you're in the Depression because they're so kind of amazing. But the simplicity of that life does have echoes to that time, I think. It's hard not to be in those shacks and not to think about what it must have been like in those times. But, you know, you still, many of the shacks in the Royal National Park, for example, are walk-in. And they don't have lots of amenities, and they are very simple still, and that's part of their enduring charm.
Are you looking at the literature of the beach shack?
I am trying to. I'm trying to. And I'm also really interested in people's memories of the beach shack, as you said, you know, that people think that they have a connection with a beach shack, which might be through literature if it wasn't their own experience. But I think a lot of people do have connections where they might have visited a beach shack with friends, families as a child, and it can have quite a powerful imprint. I'm also really interested to think about, you know, when we go on holidays, beach shacks have a kind of a summer, a wonderful sort of basicness of living by the beach for an extended period of time and fishing and sort of being conscious of the tides and the wind and the changing weather. And I'd be interested to sort of compare that with how it felt for those in the Depression. I mean, I've come across lots of memories of children who sort of reminisced nostalgically about it being a very free and lovely time because they were with their parents and there was so much freedom and they were living by the beach. But I'm also interested about the extent to which there might have been shame and desperation of people who'd been evicted. You know, there's sort of incredible sort of funny accounts of someone, a family, being evicted in dark humour, I should say, being evicted in Glebe and saying, "Oh, don't worry, we'll just go to our weekender."
You know?
And they've gone. They went down to La Perouse to their illegal fishing shack by the beach in La Perouse. In a settlement called Happy Valley. And so to what extent is that kind of dark humour masking actually a deep anxiety and that change in sort of the emotions attached to those places that I'm also interested in. And that's actually really hard to find.
I'm talking to the historian Anna Clark about her investigation of the Australian beach shack. Anna, it must have felt so different for people in shacks if they were there for the summer, a holiday, a break from their lives, or that's where they lived.
Mm. Yes, that's right. The sort of and still to this day, there are sort of permanently occupied beach shacks, although they're much much sparser than those that are used for holidays. That sense of trying to make a life for yourself in those places. You know, the coast is not the easiest place to live. It's great for fishing, but if you have to live there permanently and, say, in the Depression, you're unemployed and need to barter food, you can get a sense of the sort of desperation and the difficulty of that.
It's interesting though, isn't it, that they lived in settlements of shacks because I suppose they were looking after each other to some extent.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that comes through when you look at, you know, a number of these shack communities, particularly in Western Australia, but also in New South Wales as well. They've got sort of Facebook groups and community associations. And one of the things that keeps coming up in the heritage reports where these sort of shack communities are trying to save themselves from being, you know, demolished or moved by local councils is that sense of communitarian spirit as a sort of an enduring theme that is one of the attractions and one of the things that should be preserved about the shack communities.
Let's go behind the glamour to talk about the hazards of life in a shack. I want to go down a list of hazards with you, Anna. First hazard, sand.
Sand everywhere. If you don't like sand, I mean, probably a beach shack is not the place to be. It's a kind of an amazing thing because in a way it's beautifully protected from the beach. You know, you've got four walls and a roof, hopefully, but the wind still whistles through the shacks usually. You know, they're not built to particular standards and you feel kind of cozy and snug. But also they're quite precarious and the elements do manage or have a habit of getting inside if you think of wind and sand. In places in Western Australia, the dunes march across the shack communities and it's actually a battle to sort of keep the sand out.
They swallow them?
Yeah.
Okay, sand, mosquitoes.
Yeah, I think my backyard in in the inner west of Sydney is worse than camping. But yes, absolutely, mosquitoes, ticks.
Ticks, of course. But what was the old way of dealing with mosquitoes before we had Mortein coils?
I guess lighting a fire.
Smoke.
Yeah, smoke them out. And if anyone sort of lit a fire by a shack with driftwood, there's plenty of smoke.
Winter.
Cold, no insulation, damp. Yeah, I suppose it depends where you are though too, because there's something sort of delightful about feeling the seasons change in a very basic and humble place. You really feel like the inside is quite part of the out.
Privacy.
Again, this is something that we have all become quite used to, I suppose, in modern life. If you think of, you know, a housing advert, how many bathrooms are in a modern house? Everyone has privacy all the time if they want. But perhaps our parents' generation or grandparents' generation, there would be one bathroom in the house and children would absolutely share bedrooms for a long time, maybe even with their grandparents. And the shack, I suppose, is a reminder of that living on top of each other. And when it's a holiday, like, I think my kids actually really enjoy being in one room. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if they'll listen to this. They might ring up and complain. But certainly for a
long
time.
We do corrections on Late Night Live.
Yeah, you might get an angry email at some point. But certainly when they were young, they actually, I think, enjoyed being in a room with us. And there's something about, you know, that the sort of family being together, extended and mixed. And, you know, I don't mean necessarily a nuclear family either, but there's something about togetherness and kind of living on top of each other, which can also be nourishing.
You mentioned hippie shacks. Your experience is a hippie shack experience. Mm. What's the history of the shack that you go to?
The shack that I go to on the south coast of New South Wales was built by hippies. On my grandparents bought a farm there in the late 1960s, and some hippies asked if they could build a shack on their property. And my grandparents they said, yes, sure, why not? It shouldn't be a problem. And they built this incredible collection of, you know, two little one-room buildings, one of them out of old hardwood from a timber yard, and treated hardwood, and the other built from stones from the beach and driftwood. And if you think about, you know, living there with three children, with just tank water, boiling nappies over the fire, I think it was pretty remote.
When you said hippies, I had an image of sort of dope-smoking kids playing the guitar, but this was a family.
I think it also included smoking and guitar playing, probably not with the children, but that's with the time. It was, you know, a sort of an attempt to try something different and to get out of the city. I mean, one of the people who designed this shack, Mary Anderson, she had worked as an architecture student on the Sydney Opera House, and she was dropping out as a hippie and to live in the bush in this teeny tiny one-room shack.
How long did they live there for?
I think it was a couple of years, but it got very remote. You know, it was a dirt drive all the way into the nearest town. It would have been, you know, pretty difficult. And eventually they left and went to a commune in the mountains nearby.
Look, I'm wondering, in the time we have left, could you tell me what it is about fishing? I mean, my father was a fisherman. I mean, he fished from boats, he fished from the rocks, he fished. I never understood it.
I can see by your face.
Anna, what is it about fishing?
For me, it's about being in a place. I mean, there's a sort of an excitement of fishing, which is, if you like that excitement, then, but it's the same excitement you might get from
excitement.
The thrill of catching a fish, the jerk on the line. I mean, if you don't, I'm not going to tell you how to feel.
No. I want to know how you feel.
Yeah, sure. Well, I get the same kind of thrill from catching a fish as somebody who's been looking for a Gouldian finch for 4 years might feel, you know.
Or turning up the great document that finally explains.
Exactly. It is like that. But there's an adrenaline rush of the physicality of fishing. And I think one of the pleasures of it, Robert Hughes has written beautifully about this. It's not actually about the end result, about the catching of the fish, which is can be hugely thrilling if it's a big fish or you've been fishing for a long time with nothing and you get a bite and it's all embodied. So you feel that tug and you have to reel it in and you have to deal with the live creature and you have to either put it back or you have to kill it. It can be quite visceral.
So there's a life and death decision there.
There's definitely a life and death decision. But so much about fishing, 99% of the time you spend fishing is not catching a fish. So why do we do it?
That's also the question. I would say 99.99%.
Perhaps. Depends how good a fisher you are, I suppose.
That's fair enough.
And in that other 99% or 99.99%, you're being in a place like a bushwalker or a birdwatcher. And it's a beautiful... it's a form of mindfulness, I suppose, where I can literally stand in a spot and a kingfisher might dart before my eyes. Or, last week I was fishing in a lake, an estuary, and an octopus was sort of feeling around my feet, just sort of gently, a tentacle coming across my sneakers. I was knee deep in water, and then it just jumped onto my legs, flashing madly. And I was like, "What are you doing? It's my leg." So you have these kind of extraordinary encounters with the natural world and, tides and wind and waves. It's a way to take you outside yourself, I suppose.
And then you bring the catch home. But as a woman fishing, you can't expect your husband to clean your catch in a way that traditionally in Australia men have brought their catch home and the women gut and scale the fish. Where are we in Australia on this important question?
That's an interesting one. I've always loved fishing since I was a little girl, and one of, my fondest memories is going fishing with my dad and my uncles and my granddad. But I was the only girl in my extended family who did fish. So it still is overwhelmingly, it feels like a male pursuit, but actually a lot of women fish. Maybe 30% of women of fishers are women. So there are a lot of quiet, mindful women fishers out there who enjoy both the contemplation but also the action, I'd say.
Anna, thank you very much. I've been talking to the great historian, Anna Clark, about her absolutely public passion for A, fishing, and B, the shacks of Australia, still dotted, still surviving around the coast, and about to be part of the subject of her History of the Beach. Anna, thanks.
Thanks, David. It's lovely.